Sighting. Apple Store, Soho, New York City. General store-wide freakout. I am asked to pose with people for cell phone pictures. The store greeter cannot believe that I am me. She jumps up and down. They have no idea why I am there. Answer, iPod docking cable. Someone on the staff starts to play videos of me on a giant screen. Suddenly, I am like a mascot walking around a theme park. I'm Charlie Chaplin at Universal Studios, and everyone wants to kiss me.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. This week, we're joined by humorist John Hodgman. You might recognize him from The Daily Show, where he's a, quote, resident expert, or from the public radio show This American Life, or from those Mac commercials, where he plays a PC. Hodgman's new book, More Information Than You Require, is a collection of amusingly fake trivia. And it picks up where his best-selling last book, The Areas of My Expertise, left off. This reading of John Hodgman's More Information Than You Require was recorded in October 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Good evening. My name is John Hodgman. A couple of years ago, I wrote a book of complete world knowledge entitled The Areas of My Expertise. It was your standard almanac of trivia, all sorts of fascinating trivia and historical oddities and amazing true facts, with the advantage that they were all made up by me. It was an advantage to me. Now, some people say we're very skeptical. They're like, how can you contain complete world knowledge within a book that is only 236 pages long? And the answer is very simple. I lied. It was not complete. For indeed, knowledge, time has passed and more knowledge has been generated, and I have learned it. And my life has gone through a remarkable transformation, where once I was a mere professional literary agent and freelance magazine writer. Through unexpected fate and bizarre circumstance, I have since become a famous minor television personality. And so I come to you now again with a new volume of complete world knowledge, now extra complete, entitled More Information Than You Require. This is the new technology. If you had the previous technology of The Areas of My Expertise, you may throw it away. No, actually, you must not throw it away, for this does cover new material, including the past, as there's always more of it left, the future, as apparently there's still some left. I don't know how much. All of the presidents of the United States, the secrets of Hollywood, gambling, the sport of the asthmatic man, including hermit crab racing, the best, strange encounters with aliens, how to buy a computer, how to be a famous television personality, minor television personality, how to cook an owl, and all sorts of subjects that you may need. But it is not a sequel to my book exactly. It is a direct continuation. Indeed, if you look in your book, you will see that the first page is page number 237, insofar as it picks up exactly where the last book left off. There is also a technological advance in this book as well that I'd like to tell you about if you're considering buying it, that I think is going to seal the deal. And that is, in my last book, I was very frustrated that no one turned it into a page-a-day calendar, because that is where the money is. Everyone loves the page-a-day calendars, and I thought that my book, with all of its amazing factoids, would be a delightful addition to the canon of great page-a-day calendars, such as 365 or 6, including leap year jokes about page-a-day calendars, and, of course, The Anxiety of Influence by Harold Bloom, that very famous page-a-day calendar that is so successful that I hate him. So in this book, I took a preemptive strike, and I decided to make this book not just a mere book, because who needs another one of those, but it is also a page-a-day calendar. If you look through the book, you will see, well, this is a better example here. If you look through the book, actually, do you have a copy? Here, let me show you. If you look through the book, you will see that every page has a date on it, beginning, obviously, with the first day of the year, the day that this book was published, on October 21st, several days ago. And on each page, I have the date, and then I have a little interesting fact from history that did not happen on that date. Or on any date. So, for example, today is October 23rd, and this happens to appear on the title page, because we were running out of pages, so we had to make use of the title page for this little scheme, which delighted my designer very much. And on this date in 1978, on CBS 2001, A Space Odyssey, a television program premieres. This is one of several science fiction shows to be rushed into production on television following the success of Star Wars, including Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, Battlestar Galactica, the original series, which itself was a reimagining of the classic Battlestar Galactica radio program from the 20s, and Taxi also was a science fiction program. 2001 was one of the most expensive television shows to produce, and it attracted enormous ratings at first, but the audience dropped off after a few episodes when it was revealed that the only cast members were apes and floating fetuses, and all the dialogue was telepathic. And so there you have it. That is the page a day, and as this is a page a day calendar, you can go ahead and tear that page right out. And that's, you just enjoy that the way you would enjoy any other page a day calendar. There you are, ma'am. Thank you. I might recommend you want to buy two copies of the book, in fact. One so that you can enjoy it as a page-a-day calendar, or just enjoy destroying it, which is also your prerogative. And then one as an archival copy that you do not necessarily destroy, or destroy again if you feel that strongly about it. That's just a little introduction to the new technology of the book. I will happily buy that book for you if you wish. Because I destroyed it. Anyone else want me to tear up their books? In my book, I present a lot of useful information. This is, I think, a more useful book than the last one. That is another reason why you should purchase at least one archival copy and perhaps two. For example, I tell you how to tell the future, the old-fashioned way that the old farmers used to do, by taking a spleen out of a live pig and examining the spleen. You think that it's a joke, ma'am. You know I don't show up on film. You're going to be very disappointed when you run down the battery on your... It is true that the particularly Norwegian-American farmers would cut open a pig and take the spleen out and examine it for auspices and predictions of the coming year. I don't know how they did this, probably because they were high, is my guess. And usually I would imagine that the prediction was, this pig will not survive. If you have infestations in your home, I tell you how to get rid of several common infestations, ants, mice, silverfish, Scottish terriers, this sort of thing. Any of you have Scotty dogs on the walls? It's the worst. That's the worst when they get in there and they're scrambling around, yapping at each other. Their horrific dander gets everywhere. Ugh. But, you know, you don't want to... It's really bad, but you don't want to kill them, of course, because they're very cute. So here's what you do. This is my little trick, a humane way to get rid of the Scotty dogs that are infesting your apartment or home. You take the white ones, and you take the black ones, and then you turn them around the other way from each other, and they repel each other. A little Scotty dog magnet humor. I don't even know if they make those anymore, do they? And I also offer information about all sorts of home cures and hangover cures, for example. If you go out drinking too much, here's a good hangover cure. You take just a glass, normal glass, and you have to get some really good cold ice. And you put that in the glass, and then you get some tonic water because it has quinine in it, and some lime for the citric acid, and then gin for the curative juniper that it contains. You may notice that I'm wearing a tuxedo. This tuxedo was given to me by Gentleman's Quarterly magazine. I have to say that because I did not always look this good. I used to look like garbage. I own this tuxedo. I don't have to rent tuxedo like you people. But it was not always this way. You know, when I was a freelance magazine writer, I could not own a tuxedo. I had to rent a tuxedo. I had to rent my pants. I had to rent regular clothes. In a rent-to-own scheme that robbed me of all my money. I was poor. I was very poor. I only ate ramen noodles, but I couldn't even afford the water. It cost too much to heat it up with that little element that you drop into the mug. You know that depressing thing, the most depressing little heating element of all time? Too much money for me. I just would survive on the noodly biscuit. I'm not proud of it, but I'd snort the flavor packet. Just for a cheap high. It was grim. Let's just put it that way. It was grim in my life. But then my life went through a remarkable transformation. And I became a famous minor television personality. And people started giving me tuxedos. And I started buying my own pants. Now I buy new pants every day. I'm like Jay-Z. I wear a pair of pants and then throw them away. Never look at them again. And to me, that's perfectly normal now. To me, that's that kind of glamour. That's my life now. That's as normal to me as breathing underwater. Oh, I'm sorry. Have you people not gotten the gill operation yet? That is because you are poor. Nowadays, my life is very glamorous, as you can imagine. I go to Los Angeles quite a bit to work in the television and in the films. Excuse me. I fly to Los Angeles a lot because that's really the fastest way to get to Los Angeles, I've discovered. And the best way to go, luckily, is for me, is I'm occasionally flown first class. And it's very nice. It's very nice indeed. Have you ever seen it? Of course you've seen it. You have to walk through it to get where. Oh, how we chortle at you as you walk through. You may wonder, why do you do that? Why put first class right up front? Do you have to walk through it before we go back to our, what is it, coach seats? Or do you just climb up a ladder and sit on the roof of the plane? Well, I'll tell you, because, you know, the first class is up front so that people in first class can get on the plane first and get off the plane first, because we have places to be, unlike you. And also, we want to see you as you walk by, because that's what first class is all about, lording it over people. This is how I've learned to be. It's rather disgusting, I realize. And there are sometimes I see other famous people in first class. Lonnie Anderson. That's a true story. These are all true stories, by the way. None of this is made up. Lonnie Anderson at the airport, they have the Admiral's Club where the admirals go to hang out, drink some grog, sing some sea shanties before they get on the plane and fly it. And at Los Angeles International Airport, there's not only the Admiral's Club, but there's a super secret extra Admiral's Club for people in first class, which is always empty because no one flies first class. And one time, it was just me in that room and Lonnie Anderson. And I'm like, I hope Lonnie Anderson's on my plane, and I hope I get to sit next to her because I'd like to talk to her. But I didn't get to sit next to Lonnie Anderson. True story. It's a good one, right? Kurt Russell didn't sit next to him. Kurt Russell is a handsome man. Let me tell you something right now. I'm happily married to a wonderful woman who looks just like Kurt Russell. And he reminds me of my wife. No, but he looks fantastic. He looks fantastic. No eye patch, surprisingly. That surprised me. I guess he grew his eye back after he escaped from New York. Maybe once he went to Hollywood, he found a good cosmetic surgeon. It's fantastic. But he didn't sit next to me because he was sitting in the middle. In the first class cabin of American Airlines, there are only 9 seats in first class because they're about 3 blocks wide. So you have 2, 4, 6, 8 on the aisles and then one right in the middle, the captain's chair. No one wants to sit there because you're sitting in a panopticon. Everyone's looking at you, walking around you. You know, like you feel like you have to greet people as they get on the plane. Like, you know, go for your purser. Hello. Welcome to my plane. I mean, you want to relax when you're on the plane. You don't want to feel like you might have to fly it at any moment. But as you're right in the middle, it's very weird. But he was very gracious about it. He didn't, you know, he wasn't spotted at all. He didn't have any problems with sitting in the captain's chair. He's a bigger man than I was. He looked fantastic. And naturally, when I tell these stories, people wonder, what does it feel like? And, you know, how did it happen? And so I wrote about that in my book. And I'm going to read a little bit of it to you now. It's possible you may have heard some of this information on public radio's This American Life. But if you did, don't despair, because there's a lot more information in here than I was able to read there. And a lot of it is about Battlestar Galactica. So my recent visits to Los Angeles happened rather late in my life. Until I was an adult, pretty much, my only experience with Los Angeles had been a visit to Universal Studios as a child. This had to have been before 1985. I can't remember exactly when it was, but it had to have been before 85, because I remember at the Universal Studios tour, they still had an attraction called Battle of Galactica, as I'm sure you have no memory of. This was the portion of the Universal Studios tour when the motorized tour tram left the back lot of a movie studio and somehow ended up in a space station. And once inside the station, robots would shoot lasers at you, and then two men wearing space helmets would bound out and pretend to kill the robots. Now, I want to be very clear about this, because I find it quite tragic. Our rescuers in this ride, the two men with space helmets, these were living men. They were not animatronic creations. These were actual guys, actors, I guess you would call them. And they would run out and rescue people dozens of times a day. And they had, you remember this, Beardo, don't you? Yes, I know. This is my man for Rachel Hunter and Battle of Galactica. Well, then you'll remember, like, they had lines. They're like, don't worry, we're going to save you. Don't worry, we're going to save you. But the reality is that they never said those lines. The lines were recorded and played over a PA. They had been recorded long ago by other, presumably better actors than the two guys who had to act it out. And I thought, even at the time, I was perhaps about 10 years old, that is a remarkable kind of torture. But it amused me, and it still does. They closed that ride not long after my visit because the TV show it was based on was canceled, and because weird live space mime shows went out of fashion at the amusement parks. I may have been the last to even see that ride, and after the ride was over, I sat down on a bench to ponder and absorb this historic moment. And that is when I was approached by a grown man pretending to be Charlie Chaplin. Now, I guess it is some people's dream to meet Charlie Chaplin, or even someone dressed as him. But even as a 10-year-old, I found Chaplin's work to be pretty maudlin and cheap. He was no Buster Keaton in any case. And as Chaplin approached, I considered saying so to his face. But there was a problem. At this time in my life, I had very long hair. It was an affectation, and an awful one at that. But it was a better affectation, I might argue, than, say, dressing up as Charlie Chaplin, even if you were doing it for money. But this wasn't the problem. The problem was that I was a small child, without a beard or mustache, and thus people routinely thought I was a girl. And this would lead to occasional embarrassing situations in my life. Double takes, for example, when I would go into a men's room, or being referred to as Joan Hodgman, or being expected, for example, to kiss Charlie Chaplin on his white powdered cheek. All of these things happened. All of the time. And so the moment came, after some predictable cane and bowler hat shenanigans, that Charlie Chaplin sat next to me and indicated he was ready for me to kiss him. For obvious reasons, his expectations were unspoken, just as mine were quite clear. I did not want to kiss Charlie Chaplin. But let's just say they didn't call him the little tramp for nothing. He waited me out. It was clear I was powerless. It was clear what was going to happen. And in the end, I let it happen. So that was my introduction to Los Angeles, a traumatic homosexual silent comedy date rape. At the time, I had no idea why someone would expect a complete stranger to want to kiss him on the cheek just for showing up and sitting down. But now I understand, because now I am on television. Sometimes I am asked, how is it that you became a famous minor television personality? And my answer is always the same. I went on television. It's pretty much as simple as that. I wrote a book. I was asked to be a guest on a popular fake news television program to promote that book. They liked it. They asked me to come back. I thought they were being polite. They were serious. I started doing comedy for that daily show that will remain unnamed. I don't know why I'm not naming it. I don't know why I'm being coy about it in this essay. And then through that, I was asked to audition for a series of computer commercials for an unnamed company called Apple Computer. And I went on the audition thinking that it would be an amusing adventure to audition for something, for a job that I would never get, but accidentally I got the job. And that's how it happened. It's your pretty typical, mundane, overnight Hollywood success story. The only thing that makes it unusual is that it actually happened more or less overnight, and largely by accident. And as a result, I am older and fatter and more wall-eyed and tweedier than most people who are just starting out on a television career. I'm not being modest. When you're on television, you don't just see the pose you've perfected for the mirror. You see yourself from all angles, clearly and cruelly, as if you were in the body of another person. Here are some of the words that internet blogs have used to describe me. The pudgy John Hodgman. Chubby John Hodgman. The round John Hodgman. The stout PC. The tubby PC. Portly John Hodgman. And cutie. That last one came from a website that includes a regular feature that maps celebrity sightings in New York City. In this case, the anonymous tipster reported, accurately, that I was taking the B train south from my observatory on the Upper West Side, where I then lived. I don't live there anymore. And it was not an observatory. And I will not tell you where I live now. But it's in my book. In detail. Now, here's what happened on that train ride from my point of view. I was just a normal person on the train. I was riding the train. I had been wearing my brown jeans and my brown coat, an outfit that a neighbor of mine had just told me it made me look like a UPS delivery man. And I was just riding the train, casually deciding never to speak to that neighbor again, when a woman got on the train, and she gave me a quick double take as if I were a girl in the men's bathroom. And then a man came on the train, and he also did a double take, and I began to figure out what was happening. Now, which one was it? Which one of these fellow travelers was the anonymous tipster? Well, I will probably never know. Neither of them seemed drunk or insane, and yet one of them must have been the one who told the internet that I was a cutie. Whoever it was, they then went on the internet to note that I also looked like a UPS man. So here is a fashion tip from the stars. Don't wear brown jeans, ever. After that, these unexpected brushes with fame, in which, unexpectedly, I was the famous person, started happening with some frequency. Sighting, the Radio Shack, Big Y Plaza, Greenfield, Massachusetts. The young guy at the counter asked me to autograph an old receipt. What are you doing here? He asked in a voice that contains a host of further questions, such as, what are you doing in Massachusetts? What are you doing in Greenfield? What are you doing at Radio Shack? Answer, I was buying speaker wire. Sighting, Northwest Airlines flight from Philadelphia to Minneapolis. Soon after closing my eyes to go to sleep, I hear a click and see a flash. My eyelids briefly light up, blood red inside. I open my eyes and look across the aisle. A 10-year-old boy is putting a camera away. He had taken my picture while I was asleep. For one of those weird websites, I guess, that 10-year-olds are running. I ask for him to be removed from the plane. But it is too late, as we're already in the air. a toy store near my old Upper West Side observatory. I am waiting for my daughter. I have a daughter, by the way. To protect her privacy, I refer to her only as Hajmina. I am waiting for my daughter, Hajmina, to complete her many purchases. A man there is with his own daughter. We say hello, as parents do. And then he gives me a conspiratorial look and says, "You are John Hodgman." "Yes," I say, and then I pause. I ask him why he put it that way. Why did he say, "You are John Hodgman"? The man then explains that he had seen me and my family in Riverside Park the previous weekend having a picnic. "That is true," I say. He then explains that he and his wife had an argument about it. They fought over whether I really was John Hodgman, and that when he saw me just now, he realized that it really had been me that day in the park having lunch with my family, completely unaware that I was being watched and scrutinized the entire time by strangers. "Yes," I say, "that's true." He smiles now, realizing that he has won the argument with his wife. "So," he says, "you must live in this neighborhood." I say, "Yes." "Where exactly?" he says. And then I tell Hajmina, "It is time to go." The Museum of Television and Radio, New York City. I go to a party to celebrate the new season of Battlestar Galactica. Not the old version that had the ride at Universal Studios. I'm talking about the new version of Battlestar Galactica, the one in which the robots are erotic, finally. I am here because I had written about the show for a national magazine back when I was merely a professional writer, before I had ever been on television. I was there really as a fan. And now at the party, I'm enjoying catching up with one of the show's creators, whom I met when I was writing the article, and I'm trying to offer him my congratulations on the success of the show. But he isn't listening. All he wants to know is how it happened. How had I gone from writing about TV to actually appearing on TV? And I explained to him as I explained it to you, and then I confessed that I felt a certain shame. I felt a certain shame that I leapt past thousands, millions of trained actors and journeyman performers to get a job that I had not earned. I paid a lot of dues in my life as a writer, as a literary agent, as a cheesemonger, but not really as an actor. I did not even need to work, for example, many long and silent days at the Battlestar of Galactica ride. I mean, the Battle of Galactica ride. Oh, I blew that one, didn't I? You know what I mean. I'm talking about those two guys that I was talking about before. Did you catch the reference? Yes, thank you. Thank you. An audible yes was appreciated. Thank you. Yes, I understand. Good. It was a good reference, wasn't it? That's what I thought. At the very moment that I'm saying this and feeling this, a waiter passing by with a tray of cocktails that have luminous sci-fi ice cubes in them comes by and he says, "I hope I am feeling better." And it takes me a moment to realize that he's referring to a television ad in which I pretend to have a sneezing fit. And I laugh and I tell him, "Thank you." And then, like a sneezing fit, it doesn't stop. One person after another comes up to me, talking about the ads, wanting to say hello. Soon, an Academy Award-winning actress is shaking my hand and congratulating me for a job well done on television. It is very fun, but it is also very confusing and uncomfortable for me, and I think for everyone there. Suddenly, no one knows why I'm there anymore. I don't fit in. What role am I supposed to be filling at this party? Am I a journalist? Am I a fan? Am I now a minor E-list TV personality there to lend the party a little E-list buzz? This kind of hierarchical uncertainty is unwanted at any party, and especially not a television party. And I worry that I am somehow ruining the night for my space friends. So the first moment I can, I sneak away and go home alone in the rain. These are all true stories. Sighting, Apple Store, Soho, New York City. General store-wide freakout. I am asked to pose with people for cell phone pictures. The store greeter cannot believe that I am me. She jumps up and down. They have no idea why I am there. Answer, iPod docking cable. Someone on the staff starts to play videos of me on a giant screen. Suddenly, I am like a mascot walking around a theme park. I'm Charlie Chaplin at Universal Studios, and everyone wants to kiss me. When you are a young person, all of this feels inevitable. It feels inevitable that you will be on television, particularly people of my generation. I'm 21. It feels inevitable that you will be on television or that you will be an astronaut or the president. It's hardwired in every gland, this ambition to be known and renowned. And then, of course, you grow older, pudgier, stouter, portly. You have children or you get a job or are drawn by fate to one life or another. Only the deranged don't notice that the possibilities for life are narrowing. And only the happy look around and say, that is fine. I accept that I will never be a famous minor television personality. At least I have written this wonderful book of fake trivia. I am a happy person. And then, just when you've discarded the last shred of a shred of a shred of the fantasy of, say, being an astronaut, it is unsettling to have someone then knock on your door and just say, out of the blue, it's time for you to go into outer space. And you don't get used to it. You put on the spacesuit and you learn to eat dehydrated food and you learn to poop while floating upside down. But you never feel like you're really supposed to be up there orbiting the Earth. And honestly, now that I think about it, you don't even have to go into space at all to get this feeling. You can get the same feeling just by being asked to pretend to go into outer space by, for example, doing a cameo appearance on the new Battlestar Galactica, which is exactly what happened to me. These days, when I come to L.A., it is not traumatic. It's a lovely city, and especially so if you are on television. Recently, I was there, and I stayed in a very fancy hotel, which I will not name because I want to stay there again and again and again. The woman at the door greeted me by name before I even checked in. And I stayed in a room where I am told a very famous person died. And I saw famous people there. Jerry Stiller. And then I saw another person as I was checking out of my room. See, my room had a private entrance to the street, and I pulled up my car and was putting my suitcases in my trunk. And the door to the next room opened, and a man came out. And I nodded to him, hello, just a couple of fellow guests at the hotel, neighbors really. Good morning, I said. It was Justin Timberlake. I said good morning, and he jumped. I don't mind telling you that Justin Timberlake was freaked out. He actually jumped and made a sort of grunt. And as Justin Timberlake grunted at me, and then immediately made his way down the street as quickly as possible, I understood in a way I never could have before what I had done to this poor millionaire superstar. I made him feel trapped and cornered and vulnerable, and I felt terrible about it. I felt really terrible about it. Even as I followed him down the street, I felt terrible. I felt terrible about it. Even as I followed him down the street screaming his name, trying to take a picture of his vagina, I felt awful. Every time I check out from that hotel, I don't know if I'll get to stay there again. Television came along and cast the spell on me. It would be naive to imagine that the spell could not break just as quickly. That's a Hollywood story, right? To be discovered out of nowhere and then to be forgotten. That's showbiz. As a matter of fact, sometimes now, if I'm feeling tired or a little sad, I'll go and put on my UPS man outfit and hit the subway. I'll hope that maybe someone will recognize me. It's very embarrassing, isn't it? But most of the time, it doesn't happen. No matter how crowded it is, most of the time no one says anything. They're reading, talking, thinking about their own journey, where the train is taking them next. They don't say anything to me at all. And that's when I sit back and I look at them all, and I think to myself, don't any of you have a television? I'm sitting right here. What the fuck is wrong with you people? So this is normally the part of the presentation where I would entertain questions from the audience, if you have any. You know, I used to feel very uncomfortable taking questions because it just made me nervous, and now I have much more confidence. I appear before audiences all the time, and so I feel much more comfortable about it. And I love the sort of spontaneous give and take that we get to enjoy in these sessions, and I know that you have some questions because I wrote them for you. I also happen to have written the answers, and I need to find them before I let you ask the question. This is how I do it. Just town hall style. Okay. Yes, sir, what is your name?
My name is Bobby.
Hey, Bobby, what's your question?
I got into a bar brawl last night and ended up losing a tooth. I've considered getting an implant, but I think the gap in my smile looks kind of badass.
Whoa. There are children here, Bobby.
Excuse me, bad roar.
Yes.
What do you think? Should I leave it alone or go to the dentist?
Good question, Bobby. Here's my answer. If you were really a bad roar, you wouldn't be asking me for advice. You would just go to the dentist and punch that guy in the mouth. Hint, because that is a dentist's weak spot. Elsewhere on their bodies, they feel no pain, thanks to their intimate knowledge of topical anesthetics. That is why fighting a dentist is like hitting a bag of angry meat. Also, I know nothing about fighting, by the way. But if the dentist beats you down, and let's face it, that's probably what's going to happen, he or she will likely force you to get a fake tooth implant. In this case, please make sure that it is a removable fake tooth, like the kind Robert Shaw had in the movie Jaws. Then you can choose how badass and drunken sailor-y you wish to appear at any given time by pulling the tooth out at will. That will shut up those fancy pants marine biologists. Thank you very much, Bobby, for your question.
Thank you.
You may ask a real question in a moment. Not yet.
All right.
There's another man waiting with a question that I wrote. You stand behind him. Yes, what is your name, sir?
The paper doesn't say.
Well, what is your actual name?
Rick.
Rick, hey, how are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
Good, you have a question for me by any chance?
Conveniently, I do.
Oh, good.
I want to get a tattoo, but I can't decide on the right one. I want something that makes me look cool, but doesn't completely horrify my parents. Any suggestions?
Good question. I thought that tattoos were amusing myself until my own daughter got a huge face and neck tattoo of Dan Zanes. Really? No one knows who Dan Zanes is? Yeah. Yeah, calling out the names? Yeah. It turns out that a full face and neck tattoo of Dan Zanes is the only tattoo that looks cooler on a 37-year-old than a 5-year-old. And the whole family regrets it. Generally speaking, I think there is a generation of former hipsters and aging sorority sisters and cannibal whale harpooners who will deeply regret the tattoo fad once they catch a view of their 50-year-old scrawled upon bodies in the mirror after they shower in the future. The one exception I would venture is if you get a Mad Magazine fold-in tattooed on your belly, which reveals a new picture as your flab and folds increase with time. I think that would be delightful. But if you really want a new look, why don't you just try busting out your own tooth? Thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Now, Bobby, why don't you come back and ask your actual question? We can take some actual questions now. And obviously, if you have questions, you can line up there, and then I'll also throw it over here if anybody has a question over there. Bobby, what's your real question? And I will answer it the best I can.
I was hoping you'd talk a little bit about your writing process, because obviously this is much different than, you know, researching a nonfiction book or writing a novel. So can you take us through how you came up with, I don't know, seven?
Well, obviously, did everyone hear the question? Bobby busted his tooth out in a bar brawl. The writing process question is one that is asked frequently. It's a very common question, Bobby.
I'm a very common man.
And it's a perfectly reasonable and fair question. Obviously, my work, the research in my work is scant, haphazard, and largely accidental. But I do some research. The internet is a great source of dubious scholarship for me. I discovered Wikipedia when I was, this will scare you, when I was a journalist. I wrote for the New York Times Magazine for a long time, and I would often go to Wikipedia, as most print and TV journalists do all the time, because it is not always reliable, though it is frequently quite reliable. But I mean, it's not, you can never really be sure what people are writing is true or not, but you will get a very interesting sense of what the debate is about any subject, because you'll have, especially if it's a controversial subject, you can go into the discussion section of the subject, whether it's creationism or Bobby's shirt or whatever, you know, things that people fight about. And And you'll have two, you know, we talk about crowdsourcing or, you know, like group minds sort of working on these things and correcting them. But when it's a controversial subject, you'll have two or sometimes three crowds fighting one another to try to get to tell the story the way they want it to be told. And by story, I mean the factual database. Do you know what I mean? And it reminds you that all factual databases ultimately are stories. We can't help ourselves from telling stories. And so that I find to be useful as well. But the process really is pretty much sitting down in a room, closing a door, and trying to type out things that arrange sentences. You know, no funny hats or rituals or anything else. Do you need to leave, ma'am? Oh, I thought you were getting up. I'm sorry. If anyone wants to leave, this gets very long-winded. I realize. I apologize. If you have dinner reservations, I'm going to be here till 2 o'clock in the morning. So. I will try to answer the next question from over here briefly. I mean, I'll try to be thorough, but not as long-winded as I just was. I apologize to you all. Hello.
Hi there.
What is your name?
My name is Angel.
Angel?
Yes.
Okay, very good.
Yes. I heard about the great success of HodgeCon 2008.
Oh, yeah.
And
HodgeCon
2008. I'm wondering what the plans are for this year to make it even more extravagant.
Well, HodgeCon, Angel is referring to something that I announced on Twitter, which is a internet web service. I'm not going to try to explain that. But everyone on Twitter was talking about, I think it was DragonCon, which is a big geeky convention in Atlanta. And how much fun they were having there. And I was feeling a little left out because I was just sitting. Were you there at Dragon Con?
No.
Oh, but
no,
you just nodded when I said I was feeling left out. Yeah. You understand.
We can tell.
Yeah. And I was, because I was just sitting alone in my office trying to finish a project. And so I decided that I was going to have, I was going to announce HodgeCon 08, a big convention devoted to me, attended only by me in my office. And It was quite a success. We had some very interesting seminars and a huge party at the end of the con, let me tell you. It involved me and Gibson, which is a martini with a cocktail onion in it, and also a Percocet in it. No, that's not true. And so Angel is saying, what's going to happen for HodgeCon 09? Do I have plans to expand? Expand the festivities? I don't know. We might need to get a bigger venue. I might invite Jonathan Colton next year. Jonathan couldn't be here tonight because he is he's in Dublin right now playing a concert. He's doing it. Anyone who clapped for Jonathan Colton knows exactly where it is in any moment. I don't know why I'm telling you. Forget it. I hope that answers your question, Angel.
Yes, thank you very much.
I'll go back over to this gentleman.
Hello,
boom,
Mr.
Boom,
Hodgman.
Boom. Go. What's your name?
My name is Ben.
Okay, Ben.
I have two questions. One is needlessly pretentious, and the other one is rather simple.
Okay. I will choose to answer one of them.
All right. The first is, as a purveyor of fake information, how do you feel about Michel Foucault's thesis that there is no true knowledge? Does it make you feel jealous, like there are others out there purveying similar things?
Okay, I've absorbed that question. What is the other one?
When is your new audiobook coming out?
Okay. New audiobook will come out. After this tour, we will record it. Jonathan and I have to sort of shake down what we're doing. And the previous audiobook had a lot of Jonathan Colton in it, of us talking to each other. And we had songs that we had developed over the course of the years worth of touring that we had done before. And we'd like to make it as interesting as that in some way. And we have to figure out how to make it interesting, rather than just have me reading you a bunch of tables and charts. Michel Foucault thing, well, you know, I went to Yale where I studied literary theory because after Page a Day calendars, there's no more successful field to get involved in. And Foucault's ideas about the sort of relativity of truth, and particularly the very, what I knew to be very leftist ideas that I learned in the literature department about how there is no honesty in text, there is no honesty in writing, that a piece of work, not only may an author have an agenda that he or she is not conscious of, but the work itself has an agenda that the author is not conscious of. That you'll write a text and it might mean something that the author never intended at all. I mean, that was Roland Barthes, right? The author is dead. And the idea that there is no truth, but the filter through which we perceive truth, the idea that there is no factuality, but just competing stories about what we wish to be true, I did not realize at the time, apparently made me a Republican. And now I know that the Republican Party is the most postmodern political party of all time. It's very strange that I have found those bedfellows, but there you go. See, I answered both questions. Nice vest. Yes.
Hi, Mr. Hodgman.
Hi, what is your name?
Dan.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
Good.
I think you're selling yourself a little short here. You're not just a minor television personality. You're also a minor...
Famous minor television famous personality. Minor.
You're also a famous minor film personality.
That's true. I have been in a film.
Yes, and you're going to be in a few more, I believe.
I'm going to be in another one.
And doing the voice.
Say it again.
For Coraline, you're doing the voice.
And I'm doing a voice for an animated film.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
How do you choose
What's your last name, Dan? IMDb?
Raby. So how do you choose your roles?
Oh, I don't. I'm very glad and amazed to say that, you know, I got asked to do those things because the people involved knew me from The Daily Show or were fans. The things were, I did a little bit as the man wearing glasses sitting behind a desk in the movie Baby Mama. I did a little bit as, sure, you can applaud that movie, it was great. I did a little bit as the man wearing glasses sitting behind a desk in the TV show Flight of the Conchords. Yeah. I did a little bit as the animated character wearing glasses in the movie Coraline, based on a Neil Gaiman book, which is something, obviously, I said yes to that. And then I have a forthcoming little bit as a man wearing glasses, wearing a suit, marrying two people in Ricky Gervais's new movie, The Side of the Truth, which comes out next year. And in all of those cases, I knew the people a little bit, or they knew of me, and we just got to talking and said, hey, you want to do this fun thing? I had met Ricky when I was working at the New York Times Magazine, and he asked me if I would do it, and I would say, and obviously I said yes, for a lot of money. The one job that I pursued vigorously was the chance to do anything at all in the last season of Battlestar Galactica. Might come as a surprise to you, but I was like, I must. When I heard that they're ending the series with this season, I had hired a Hollywood agent and I put them on the case. I said, I want to do something. I just want to press a button. I just want to say, aye, or yes, sir, or whatever. Yes, commander. And I really wanted to do it because I loved the show, and I really wanted to do it because I had already written that joke in the book about being asked to be on Battlestar Galactica, and it was going to really fuck up the book if I didn't get the job. So that ended up happening. Thanks, Mr. IMDb. Young woman.
Hi.
Hi. What's your name?
My name's Julia Imbriaco.
Hi, Julia. What is your last name?
Imbriaco.
Imbriaco. You know everybody here?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Hey, guys. All right.
Well, I'm a communications major over
Fantastic.
At American University. So, yeah. Like any good communications major, I did some research.
Oh, yeah?
On Wikipedia.
Yes, good.
And Wikipedia told me that you played the clarinet at
Yale.
Yeah,
along, not at Yale, in high
not
school.
Not at Yale? Mm-hmm. Well, my question is, how
Thanks,
is your...
Thanks, Wikipedia.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
And I was wondering how your clarinet playing skills have impacted the rest of your life and career choices.
I never would have gotten to where I am today without my frankly amazing embouchure. Are there any single reed players out there tonight? Really? What do you play, Baldy? Clarinet and sax, very nice. Over here, what do we got? Clarinet as well? Any double reed players? Get out. What are you? Oboe, what are you? Same. What's the English horn? What is that? Is it big oboe? Why don't they just call it big oboe? Does that answer your question?
Very much.
And you never played any of those instruments?
I play the trumpet.
You play the trumpet? Mm-hmm. Brass section. See you later.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
I have a 2000 VW Jetta that still runs fine, but seems to need more repairs than it used to. How do I know when it's time to buy a new car?
Oh, well, here's a funny story. I'm married. It gets better than that. My wife's first car was a Volkswagen Jetta, actually, circa 1990 or so, and it was a disaster. It was already in terrible shape when she bought it, and she treated it very, very badly. I don't think she changed the oil once. After 6 months, it shuddered horribly whenever it hit 50. When we drove together, I would hike my knees up to my chest and sob. I was so, so scared. Sometimes when she was driving down the highway with the car shuddering like a seizure, other drivers would pull up beside her and point at the car, screaming. She could not figure out what they were screaming about. She would pull over and take a look at the car, and everything would seem to be okay, but when she got back on the road, it would happen all over again, pointing, screaming, shouting, pale looks of absolute horror. It was a mystery. Eventually, she decided to get rid of it, and she left it on lock in New York City for weeks on end. Not difficult, because she had never been given the keys to the door. Remember when cars had different keys for the ignition and for the door? Well, this is one of them. She never got the keys to the door. She was hoping someone would just steal it. After weeks of this, she went out to check on the car, and a neighbor who was sitting on a stoop called her over. "Is that your car?" he asked. "Yes," she said. "You leave the doors open?" he asked. "Yes," she said. "I never got the keys to the doors, and I want someone to steal it." "They're not stealing it," he said. "I know," she said. "I've been watching your car," he said. "The people are not stealing it." "I know," she said. "They are having sex in it," he said. "I see," she said. And the next day, she found a used condom in the car, and she decided it was time to get rid of it for good. At first, she had the nerve to attempt to sell it. She offered it for $200 to a writer for Sesame Street. "It runs fine," she said. Yes, to get rid of this car, she lied to a writer for Sesame Street. The Sesame Street writer took it to be checked out by her mechanic. That night there was a message on our answering machine. The Sesame Street writer sounded scared. "I cannot buy your car," she said on the machine. "When I drove it across the Triborough Bridge, people were pointing and screaming at me." Our best guess is that whatever the car was in motion, some part of it was on fire. Flames from the tailpipe? We never knew for sure. Now, you may ask, why didn't she just have it towed away? The answer is, my wife did not know you could do this. Neither of us did. We were younger then, and we were not yet experts in everything. Eventually, however, someone clued her in, and she had a company take it away for $50. And years later, she would find out that the company had reconditioned the fiery sex car and sold it again. And for all we know, it's still out there. But that's not the strange thing. The strange thing is, years later, when the time came for my wife and I to buy our first car together, we both agreed immediately. Volkswagen. Brand loyalty, as every marketer knows, is a powerful thing. And not always, or even most of the time, do we choose the known over the unknown because it has been good to us. In life, we return just as frequently to what scars us. And what scars us is Volkswagen. But I digress, friend. You do not require a morality tale. You want advice. So here is a handy rule of thumb. If you have a year 2000 Volkswagen Jetta, the time to buy a new car is 1999. Thanks very much for your kind attention. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, visit npr.org/booktour.